Okay, great. So today's March 6, 2013. I'm Rick Hansen. And last week, someone asked me what the Buddha taught about boundaries, because we were talking about messy relationship problems. It was a great question because it was a stumper. You know, I kind of internally flipped through my knowledge of the Pali Canon, you know, which is pretty good. It's not perfect, but it's fairly decent. And whoop, what do we say about boundaries? So I wanted to explore that idea with you tonight, and I've had occasion to reflect on it. In kind of ordinary situations, boundary issues come up where we feel like someone is being invasive, or flipped around the other way. We have, we think, rights in certain situations, and the other person's not respecting them. Maybe they're eating our cookies, or they're putting their stuff on our shelf in the refrigerator when we share our house with other people, or talking to us in a way that we feel is inappropriate, etc. And so before I dive into that topic, though, I'd like to get a sense from you as to what might be a couple examples of boundary issues. In other words, if you were willing to, you know, changing the names to disguise the details, if you like. What are examples of interpersonal hassles of one kind or another which have a question of boundaries maybe involved in them? Yeah, Julie. First, Julie. Yeah.
Thank you. I like to help, which I see as being of service, not enabling or codependency, but be of assistance to someone. And there are times, not too often, but times when the other person feels that I am intruding on what they are trying to do, struggling as I see it, not handling their situation very well, and my assistance does not have the effect that I want it to be, which is offering there. And I don't know how to...
So you wonder if you're crossing their boundary, in a sense.
Exactly. They feel I am.
Yeah. Okay. Great example, Ryan. Okay. Another example? Yes.
Boss. And when you talked about it earlier, when you first brought it up, the first thing that came to mind to me was that when crossing boundaries is like stealing. So to me, it's like someone's taking something that's not theirs from you without your permission. So that was like the first like Dharma-ish response to what that person asked. And that's what this person felt like every time I felt violated, because it was such a encroachment on my personhood.
Okay, so if someone talks to us in ways that feel inappropriate or a violation of right speech or something, or they take our attention and we didn't offer it to them, things like that, they did not knock before entering, as it were, or they addressed us in a demeaning kind of way. Okay, maybe another one or two? Yeah.
It's a little surprising to me, but I have experienced olfactory intrusion to be devastating.
All right. How to manage that?
It hasn't always been that way, but for example, certain unnamed individuals can set out scented candles. Theoretically, to mask something else. Nobody else smells. Boy, does that hit me.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Nobody in this room. Nobody in this room.
Yeah.
And,
sure. Well, chemical sensitivities, if you think of it.
I had a childhood experience, not liking the scent of incense cedar. My mother had a box that had the comforters in it.
Yes.
Well, I have it now in our home. A certain individual didn't like that and put some air freshener in there. And I opened that by chance, which I do once every 5 years, and I smell this other stuff. And it wasn't the stuff I didn't like, but I really did like. Hello,
it hit you hard, yeah.
Unbelievably powerfully.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Involuntarily, this is just, I guess this is that limbic brain or something.
That's right, trauma. Okay. All right, last person? Yeah.
I have had a number of experiences where I invite the listening.
Yeah.
And then it's too much. And the other person just overwhelms me with words, right. And I don't, it's not a conversation, but I never know how to politely get myself,
right.
Insert myself into the conversation or stop the conversation in a way that feels both courteous and self-protective.
Right, exactly. Like, when is it possible to sign off and have that boundary respected, right? Or in couples where things can get heated, a timeout signal. And then you say timeout, and then the person keeps following you, right? As you walk out of the room, what to do, or, yeah. Okay, these are good examples, okay? Good range. So I don't have the ultimate answer to it all, but I, for sure, and I will offer a few perspectives. So reflecting on it, I thought about the very common idea, the widespread notion in psychology of really two great themes in human life, autonomy and intimacy, separation and joining, independence and connection. Well, if you think about it, they're often represented as at odds with each other. In other words, if I connect with you, I'll lose my freedom. On the other hand, if I'm really independent, if I'm really my own person, I won't have love. How to work with that? It often seems as if they're at odds with each other. And on the other hand, considerable amount of psychological research shows that the two actually support each other. For example, we have the traditional saying, fences make for good neighbors. That differentiation, separation, if you will, autonomy, actually promotes relationship. Or we have the classic finding, you know, in terms of, to stereotype, but there's a lot of truth to it, I think, as a generalization, men tend to focus on autonomy, women tend to focus on intimacy. I've known heterosexual couples in which the roles were reversed in terms of gender. The guy would say, I'm the chick in the relationship, as it were. I've seen these similar dynamics in gay couples, but that said. So we have two players, let's say, one focused a lot on autonomy, one focused a lot on intimacy. Very often what's actually the case paradoxically, as Deborah Tannen pointed out in her book on You Just Don't Understand, on gender styles, very often it's actually the case that, to genderize it, the man is actually quite confident about the underlying intimacy. He doesn't feel that autonomy threatens the intimacy, and so paradoxically, he's quite comfortable being autonomous because he already feels connected. Whereas in her case, she's also actually quite comfortable with autonomy. She knows she's her own person, so she's not threatened by intimacy, and so she really can fully enter into intimacy. I actually like that way of understanding it, in part because, as you may have noticed, the two genders can demonize each other sometimes. You know, he can describe her as this black hole of intimacy. You know, she can describe him as a very autonomous brick. And, you know, they each of them make their case about the other and, you know, bang, 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 doesn't really go anywhere. Okay? So you see, there's a lot of juice here, a lot of good stuff in this territory. So I was reflecting about this from a Dharma perspective. How could we think about it in that way? And to start with, I'd like to bring it internal. Because that's where we begin, right? And if you think about it, by becoming very intimate with ourselves, we fuel our own autonomy. By opening, I use the word in my suggestions tonight for the sitting, a kind of transparency. So we feel increasingly transparent to external stimuli. We feel increasingly transparent to internal stimuli. We really land. And in the doing of that, as again, research shows, as we become more mindful with ourselves, more tuned into ourselves, more we claim ourselves, we build up a growing sense of being rooted here. And to use the metaphor, or perhaps the truth, of the Buddha on his night of awakening, we touch the earth, and we have a basic sense of, I'm allowed to be here. It's okay. This is my place. Here I am. It's really sweet to tune in to oneself in that way, isn't it? There's really a kind of a homecoming, if you will. We're landing in ourselves, which helps us be stronger and more here. And interesting that that intimacy helps us find an autonomy. And then going into relationships, from that base of autonomy, if you will, it's interesting that, paradoxically again, intimacy with others can build up our own personal sense of autonomy, feeling like we matter. That's certainly true in early childhood. We develop a sense that we matter, and as a being who has rights herself, rights himself, by feeling seen, cherished, and valued by other people. So one of the ways that we really give others the gift of supporting their own autonomy, their own individuation, is to truly see them. Doesn't mean we approve, doesn't mean we agree, we're not waiving our rights, but we see them. I see you. You know, in traditional cultures often, the greeting is, I see you. And they mean it. They don't just, how are you, you know, like in the West, but they actually see you. I remember living in Germany for a year when I was 1968, and no, actually it was later on, I was in the mid-70s, but you would say to Germans, how are you doing? Right? And as an American, it was kind of like it's a pro forma question, but no, those Germans would stop and they'd spend 20 minutes telling you because they thought you wanted to know, right? So anyway, when these people in traditional culture say, I see you, they really, really see you, all right? So we give that gift to other people. And before I go on, though, I knew there was something I wanted to recall related to intimacy with oneself, and so I'm going to share it right now and then go back to talking about relationships, which will be my main focus here. I recently read this very lovely poem by a Zen woman who said essentially, as the moon rose, I knew myself completely, no part left out. It's very touching, isn't it? That sense of no part left out, knowing myself completely. It's that kind of intimacy with ourselves that helps us be autonomous with other people. Okay. So now back to other people, and I'm going to, if you like, offer some very specific thoughts, and then we can talk about it. Okay? So, other people, right? As Jean-Paul Sartre said, hell is other people. What are we going to do with them? All right? Remember first and foremost that we are other people to them. We are their hell. Don't forget. So the first thing I want to suggest is to have a visceral sense of being on one's own side, being for oneself, tuning into that basic body sense symbolized by the Buddha touching the earth, I have a right to be here. Or as he said for himself, not because he was the super-duper special Buddha, but because everyone can feel this way, he said, I examined the entire universe and I found no person more deserving of happiness than myself. And he really means that for everyone. For each of us, it's utterly legitimate to have a sense that we deserve our own happiness. There's this kind of visceral animal sense of, I get to be here, I get to take the next breath, I get to swallow this water, tuning into it in a visceral way, and also understanding it from a justice standpoint, that it's fair. I have rights to the property of my own attention and time. And you right now are taking this most fundamental property of mine, my attention and time, and you're taking it without asking for it. You're violating, as it were, as you brought up, the second precept. Do not take that which is not freely offered. It's not freely offered. Okay? So there's a rights principle. There's a justice principle. And you may know this, I'm going to get a little philosophical here. I was very bad at philosophy in college. I avoided it. It just seemed way too hard. So I'm kind of proud of the little philosophical knowledge I have acquired over the years. You may have heard of Hegel and the so-called categorical imperative, which is this idea that all morality really boils down to one thing, which is essentially that we would not take to ourselves rights that we would not be willing to give to others, and we would not give to others rights that we would not want to have for ourselves, all right? So in that sense, if we look at another person And we think of the situation from a rights standpoint. If it were happening to someone besides us, what would we think about it? And often we put up with a lot of mistreatment that we would get on the side of our friend with regard to if it was happening to our friend. So my first suggestion, if you will, is around a sense of being for oneself with a sense of kind of principle that one deserves decent treatment. A second suggestion is clarifying the facts and the values that are relevant in the situation. I find very often they get, you know, people do not belong to the reality-based community. Like, facts are in short supply. They have this sort of periscope submarine relationship with the facts, you know, a periscope, look around, whatever. And then they're back in their own kind of world. I think sometimes, and we are too sometimes, right? Dive. But anyway, so finding out what the facts, you know, how often, like I've seen a lot of quarrels in couples, longtime couples counselor, you know, what are the actual facts? You know, do you always do this? Do you never do that? It reminds me of the Annie Hall clip, you may know, Woody Allen and his girlfriend are side by side in their therapist's offices, and basically he says, oh my God, we never have sex, and she says, oh my God, we have sex all the time, and the therapist asks, you know, so how often do you have sex? Woody Allen goes, oh, about twice a week. She says, oh, about twice a week. You see what I mean? But the framing is really, really different. Or research on couples, heterosexual couples, again, after kids come along around housework, typically on average, the man does less than he thinks, he does less actually than he thinks he does, but he does more actually than his wife thinks he does. See what I mean? Right? Does that ring any bells? For me, it does. So questions again, you know, what are the facts? Clarifying facts, you know, kind of in a calming, clear way, tends to narrow differences. And also sorting out the relevant values. What are really the important stakes on the table here? And this is where I find often there are two levels of stakes. There's the ostensible stake, the proxy issue. How do you load the dishwasher, right? How do you talk to me? You know, do you come home at a certain time? That's the ostensible stake. Deeper than that, is the real stake. For example, are you going to boss me around or are you going to respect me? That's an autonomy stake, if you will. Alternately, are we together? Are you with me in this undertaking of making a family? Or do you care about me? That's the deeper stake. Are you willing to be honorable? This is not about the fact of this particular understanding we had. It's about a deeper question, the most fundamental agreement of all in relationships. Do you agree to keep your agreements as best you can and clean it up when you can't? Right? So that's a deeper issue. And I find that's really great to try to get at, both in oneself, as well as to have a listening to the deeper issue in the other person. That's a kind of clear seeing. And in the clear seeing, we get freer. Because instead of being stimulus-bound in the psychological term to another psychological term, the demand characteristics of the proxy issue, the thing that we're, you know, quarreling about and uptight about and getting rigid about in our minds, we can look down to the deeper issue and deal at that level, which gives us so much more freedom. Right? And this is a practice or a path of liberation. One more. There's this fairly well-known sutta in Buddhism that's well-known because it's dramatic, and basically it involves the culmination of a series of steps. Some monks came back who were complaining to the Buddha about people insulting them when they walked through a village, and they were mad at those other people and harama about them, okay? And the Buddha ultimately ended up saying, look, if you're not continually offering loving kindness in all directions to whoever you meet, you're not practicing my teaching. Even to the point that if bandits were to saw your limbs off, and if you were not sustaining loving kindness for those bandits, cutting your arms and legs off, you would not be practicing my teaching. It's pretty dramatic. So I'm thinking, well, if that's the standard, do I really need to get my knickers in a twist because my neighbor's parking in the wrong place? You know, I can still address my neighbor on facts and values and sticking up for myself and so forth, but I don't need to lose my fundamental good wishes for that person. I can both practice unilateral virtue and unilateral loving kindness, even if they are not being businesslike or keeping their own agreements with me. So the dimension of loving kindness. Last thing I'll say, and then I'll see what you think, is this fundamental idea of equanimity, which is this idea, and it's a feeling really, that as we become increasingly transparent, if you will, to stimuli coming at us and up from within us, we recognize more and more deeply in an intimate way with all things that everything is connected to everything else. It's continually quivering in this moment-to-moment sort of tapestry of reality where every thread touches every other thread. And any kind of a ripple through the whole tapestry touches all threads. And so in that larger context, when our child is being rude to us, or our neighbor is parking in the wrong place, or someone owes us money and isn't paying, or someone we've treated well is not kind to us, not letting them off the moral hook, but appreciating that phenomenon that's occurring right now is made up of many little parts, many little threads, and it's caused in this moment, painfully often, but it's caused in this moment by many little ripples through the tapestry of reality. That's equanimity. And as we recognize that increasingly, we get less rattled by what's happened. And over time, we start, the way I use it in my own mind, we start feeling less and less implicated in the mind stream of other people. We start realizing more and more that what they're thinking, how they're interpreting events, their view of us, their emotions, the reaction stream that's going on, etc., we don't really have that much to do with, actually. That doesn't let us off the hook to violate the precepts or be unvirtuous or, you know, be stupid or whatever. But it just means really realizing that most of what's going on here is just not about us. And so for me, there's a kind of, again, the language that works for me and may not work for you, is a kind of decoupling, where instead of feeling like I'm attached to other people's thoughts or reactions or view, or that I have to react to their reactions, right? Because of course they rarely see it properly, you know. If I'm stuck to them, like with a metal bar, you know, every place they move, I have to move too. Well, what am I not when this is happening? Free. Yeah, there's no freedom there. But when I decouple, when I start feeling connected more like with a bungee cord, or more like it's just sort of parallel streaming, parallel standing waves, you know, sharing the same river ultimately, but having their own kind of distinction from each other, they're disentangled from each other, then I'm much less rattled by it. So it's kind of paradoxical, isn't it, that a teaching, the Buddhist teaching, that really emphasizes interdependence and, in effect, non-dual, non-separation, still deeply recognizes meaningful distinctions, including the most fundamental distinction in the Buddhist frame, which is that your karma is not my own. In other words, the consequences of the causes streaming through you are different from the consequences of streaming through me. Otherwise, fundamentally, how could I work with my own consequences and tend to the causes for myself as I progress on the path of awakening? This is a fundamental idea, you know. And so to wrap up here, I'll just leave you with, well, I'll say it for myself. It's helped me viscerally become increasingly, as I say, de-implicated from the mind streams of other people. And so in a funny kind of way, the art, and it's a tricky business. I think of it as it's not an easy backflip on the diving board, you know, but it's doable. It's to be simultaneously lovingly present while simultaneously independent of the mind stream of the other person. Any comments or thoughts? Great.
I had a comment and a thought when you were saying that small poem that you short poem?
Yeah.
Made me think of another one. It's even shorter. It's by Issa, a haiku writer.
Mm.
Under the cherry blossoms, strangers, there are none.
Yeah.
It's the other part. It's the other side, I think, of the poem that you mentioned.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, it's there is an inevitable connection, especially when we are together.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I also wanted to comment on what you just said about not being responsible for karma.
Mm-hmm.
I use that all the time because I'm not responsible for the driver who's behind me. I mean, it isn't my karma that he got had the misfortune to be behind me.
Right.
When I don't gun my engine to leave the green light in a billionth of a second, and he's already on the horn, I'm not responsible for his karma and being behind me.
Yeah, right.
And it's so much fun.
Great. Okay, great.
I understand being able to sort of not take on other, you know, the sort of decoupling. But what would the Buddha do if he was in a relationship that was violent? Was that to how can you decouple? And then there's that sort of like, well, I'm not being a good Buddha. I should stay in this, you know, or I should stay, you know. So where, I guess, when does the line,
for,
you know, or being in jail, you know, and the Dalai Lama said, my friends, the enemies.
Yeah.
So would he go to jail or stay in jail and be the Buddha and still have love and be able to decouple but still get beat? You know what I mean? So that's when the gray error.
Yeah, I think I follow you, and I'm first, as probably other people are, you know, touched by just the genuineness, the intensity of the possibility. And, you know, to my knowledge, there's no real story that I know of that's of where the Buddha himself was attacked and he had to practice jujitsu or, you know, anything like that. There is a story where a serial killer, I think you probably know the story, Angulimala, was trying to get the Buddha, and the Buddha's response to this serial killer was, it's described as using his, in effect, supernatural powers, so that no matter how fast Angulimala ran to chase him, the Buddha was always apart from him, separate. And then at one point, Angulimala called out and said, stop, stop, why don't you stop? And the Buddha said, Angulimala, I have stopped. Why don't you? And the meaning being the Buddha has stopped craving. He has stopped putting logs on the fire of greed, hatred, heartache, and delusion. So I think a little bit for me, there is something about trusting in a little bit our own dignity, our own power, our authority. I think that's part of it. It's hard to do that, though, when someone is literally whacking you with a stick. And there, I'm just going to say what Rick Hansen thinks. I'm not going to pull in some Dharma piece. But to me, the categorical imperative cuts both ways. If you were being hit by someone with a stick, I would step in. I would, I know this. I would grab the other person. I would do what I could, all right? Well, flip it around. If we would do that for someone else, why not do it for ourselves? That's the categorical imperative. And then we also see the greater good, that if we let ourselves be interrupted or our time drained or spoken to in an inappropriate way, and particularly if what is happening, frankly, is part and parcel of a larger pattern that's historically oppressive, you know, such as male authority figures putting down females, for example, in a larger frame, we don't want to aid and abet that larger wrong. You know, we want to stand up. And I'll say the last thing, I think related to that, there's really a place in for bearing witness and being allies to things, even if we can't do anything about them. And very often the people in the pickle are enormously heartened by others who genuinely are bearing witness to the event that's occurring. They can't get in there, they can't go to jail, but they can bear witness to that, the fact through Amnesty International, let's say, that that person is in jail. You know? And then I'll just say the last thing. So I have a lot of Scottish blood in me. And I think sometimes about that, you know, and whether it's actually true, kind of archetypes. But there's a way in which I just think that I'm, on the one hand, I, by nature, quite capable of dispassion, kind of 30,000-foot view. But it's also true that there's this part of me that doesn't like being pushed around. And it doesn't like other people being pushed around. Watching bullying when I was in school, I didn't like that at all. And I think there's a lot of pushing around in the world. And there's way too much. I think people interrupt each other. They don't respect each other's boundaries or autonomy. They take things from each other. They demean each other. They act high and mighty. I remember reading this columnist for Atlantic, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who said that privilege means you don't have to pay attention. You don't have to take something into account, right? Whereas people who aren't privileged really, really have to take that distinction or that piece of business into account. And so I think there are a lot of people who are privileged and they don't take things into account. And they push other people around, and I think there's a place for speaking up. And there's effective ways to do that and not so effective ways, but I don't think we serve the world by getting in the way of their karma, as it were. You know, somebody described Stephen Gaskin karma as hitting golf balls in a tiled shower, right? You know, they come back. And I think sometimes we get in the way of the karma of other people, and there's a place for letting it land, including our appropriate proportional reaction to what they did. Sometimes we're the golf ball, and we pull our punch. And sometimes we do it out of kindness. I think often we do it out of fear, or feeling like we don't matter, or losing our nerve at the last minute. And so I just think there's a place for that. I toy with the idea from time to time about doing a workshop, you know, on Buddhist assertiveness training, which is not an oxymoron, I swear. But anyway, so I hope, I don't know. What do you think? And then we'll move to a wrap. Yeah, Tarane, and then.
Debates with another sect, and this other fellow is getting rude to the Buddha, and you probably read this, and the Buddha says, "I don't accept what you're offering."
Yeah, that right. But that's right. So there's a place for that exactly. Noble silence or disengaging or saying, you know, that verbally. Obviously, what do you do if you're in an environment where someone is grabbing you, literally grabbing you, right? Then it's a complicated thing. But yeah, that's right. I think of the thing I read in a novel written by a Native American who said, the first people's greatest weapon was silence. Noble silence, it's very powerful sometimes where you just disengage. Okay, last person, yeah. Right. Yeah, you're speaking up and then how you feel about that. Yeah. So you might, as you think about, you know, maybe a difficult relationship, you might imagine what it would be like what would happen perhaps, or you might even imagine what it would feel like in your own body. If with regard to that difficult relationship, you know, sitting at the dinner table, working side by side, knowing that you're going to see them at an event, knowing that you're going to be in court with them or something like that in an extreme case. Imagine being in a place where you are sort of simultaneously being large-hearted and wishing them well over here and virtuous over here, while simultaneously having a kind of an attitude that's respectful, that much if not all of what's streaming through that other person's mind is just irrelevant. Kind of simultaneously, loving, caring, wishing well while taking care of yourself, and simultaneously having a fundamental freedom with regard to the thoughts, the feelings, the accounts, the attributions of intention, the case that the other person's making regarding you. Is that kind of clear what I'm it's a hard backflip, you know, and I'm not saying I do it perfectly, but for me, I'm very incented to do this because it seems like the winning strategy for me personally, as well as benevolent. Okay, so let's be quiet and just let it sink for a minute here. We're not turning away from what's happening in the mind of the other person with regard to what I meant by letting it become irrelevant to some extent. We're not turning away from it, but we're feeling not so implicated in it. Take good care of yourselves.